This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
Two weeks ago, we had the shiur on the film Tairo Igra. The fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam rewards not only in accordance with the magnitude of the deed, but in accordance with the degree of effort and suffering that was invested in the performance of that deed. We went through and discussed that thoroughly and learned the Rebbitzel of Peterburger that formed the basis of that shiur. What we're going to learn tonight, as a consequence of an E of Shear this morning, is how that operates. What's the logic of the Lefum Tzara Igru? That there is Lefum Tzara Igru, we know that we are rewarded for effort and for suffering and pain invested in a good deed, that we understand. But how? Why is it so? Why should we be rewarded for the suffering involved in doing the good deed? If the productivity of the good deed is not enhanced, why be paid for the suffering? The example I gave this morning is the gardener who comes to you at the end of his day and says he wants double pay today. And you say, did you do double work today? And he says, no. And you say, did you finish your normal day's work today? And he says, no. You say, what did you leave out today? And he says, well, I did everything except for mowing the lawn and pruning the bushes and sweeping the yard and cleaning the swimming pool and everything else I did. And we say, what's everything else? So what did you do? Well, he watered a little bit here and there. And that's what he did. You say, but it rained today. What did you, yeah, it rained. So he watered where the rain didn't get there. He watered a little. That's all he did, but he wants double pay. You say, what's the swara? What do you want double pay for? He says, because I have a headache today. And you say, well, a headache today? He says, it was very hard. So it was much harder. And therefore I want to be paid for the effort I put into your garden today. It was much more effort than I normally put in. What are we going to say? Lefum tzara igra taka, yeah, lots of effort. But we don't say that. We say, sorry, we can only pay you for the work that you've done. If you put a lot of effort in and that effort is expressed in better or more work, then we can pay you for the work. Well, then we can pay you for the effort. But if you put more effort in and it's not expressed in any way in the work, that's not something we can respond with payment for. So if Lefum Tzairo Igro results in a better mitzvah, we can understand it, but then it's not Lefum Tzairo, then Hashem is paying you for the mitzvah. But if the mitzvah is not better, the only thing that is better is that it costs you more pain and suffering. What's the reason? What's the logic to expect from the Ribbono Shel Olam pain? If it's payment, schar, just for the pain and suffering, what's the basis? Eov makes a statement in the 14th Perek, which is interpreted by the Meforshim as a statement and by the Medrash as a rhetorical question. And it's this divergence of interpretation which in fact addresses the issue of the causality in Tumah and Tahara, which is a matter that perplexed minds as great as Shlomo HaMelech. Shlomo HaMelech and others were worried about causality in Tumah and Tahara. Pora Adum. What is the Pora Adum? Is it Tohur? Is it inherently Tohur or inherently Tomeh? Because it seems to have contradictory aspects to it. The people who deal with it, the people who operate it, become Tomeh. And the people upon whom it is operated become Tohu, become Tohuri. So it creates in others both purity and impurity. So what is it in essence? In essence, is it Taharo, or in essence, is it Tumo? That's the question which faces Chazal, and Chazal tells even Shlomo HaMelech could not understand that about poor Adun. Does Tumo cause Taharo, or does Tumo cause Tumo? Does an unclean thing cause cleanliness, purity, or impurity? And the posuk in Iyev is Mi Yitein Tohir Mitome Lo Yechud. Who can create from tumor, from impurity, who can create Tahara? Lo Yechud, not one. There's nobody who can do that. That's against the very principle of what tumor and Tahara is, says Iyev. And that seems to be borne out by a stunning medrash in Megillas Rut. Now the medrash says, the story is well known, but sometimes the details aren't. Rabbi Meir hove Yosef v'dorish b'hadein midrosha d'Tveria. Rabbi Meir was sitting and giving a shiur in a Beis HaMedrash in Tveria. V'hava Elisha Rabbe goziz b'shuko Rochiv al Susio b'Shabso. And Elisha ben Abuyo, the Rebbe of Rabbi Meir, who had gone off the tracks since then, was passing through the town square, riding on a horse on Shabbos, while Rabbi Meir, his ex-Talmid, was giving his shiur. Amru l'Rabbi Meir, they said to Rabbi Meir, Ho Elisha Rabcho Asi Goziz b'Shuka. Elisha, your Rebbe, is riding through the marketplace at the moment. Why did they tell Rabbi Meir that? Two possibilities, either because they knew he would want to know, or to mock him, to try and belittle him. What did Rabbi Meir do? Nofak legabe. He went out to meet his Rebbe, Rabbi Elisha ben Abuya. Imagine such a thing today, a person's Rebbe, as for Shalom, goes off, loses his Yiddishkeit, and somebody says to him, he's driving through the streets in his car on Shabbos, and the person says, oh, let me go and say Shalom Aleichem to him. That's what Rabbi Meir did. What does Elisha ben Abuya say as he meets him? He says, ah, Shalom Aleichem, Meir. First thing, Meir, what are you learning? That's what the ones who went off were like in those days. Amali, he says, I was learning much further on in Iyuv. Says Rabbi Meir, I was giving a shiur in Iyuv today, I suppose to the ladies. V'Hashem birech es acharis Iyuv mireishiso. And the posuk we were learning today was the posuk of Hashem blessed the latter end of Iyuv even more than his earlier days. It's the posuk we were learning. Amale, so Elisha ben Abuya said to Rabbi Meir, "Mo amris beha, interesting. And what did you say in the shir? How did you explain that pasuk in the shir?" Amale, he said to him, "Boruch shehichpil lo yes mamuna." The point I was making was how praiseworthy and blessed is the Ribbono shel Olam who doubled Yev's money, made him even more wealthy than he was before. Amale says, Elisha ben Abuya, don't forget, he's sitting on the horse, and Rabbi Meir is walking next to him. Says Elisha ben Abuya, he shakes his head and he says, Akiva Rabcha lo hayo imeke. That's not the way Akiva, your Rebbe, used to say, learn that pasuk. Why does he say, what's the difference how Rabbi Akiva learnt it? You remember in last night's shir, Elisha ben Abuya felt that Rabbi Meir was moving off the approach of Rabbi Akiva. And Elisha ben Abuya was concerned that Rabbi Meir should remain within the approach of Rabbi Akiva. Even though he's riding the horse on Shabbos, look at him. Elo v'ashem birech es acharis iyev mireishusoy. The way Rabbi Akiva explained that posuk is that bizchus tshuvo maisim tovim shehoyu biyodoy mireishusoy. The reason that Iyuv was blessed at the end of his days was because of the good deeds and the tshuva which existed in his earlier days. It's because of what he used to be in the old days that the Ribbono shel Olam brought him back into wealth again, into brocha again. Quite tragic that statement. He wants to learn the posuk that way, Elisha ben Abuya, because it gives him hope. One sees already, despite the fact that he's busy riding the horse on Shabbos, he likes to see that the fact that there used to be merit in somebody is preserved. And one day maybe something can be built up again out of the good points that there were before. Amale uma as amris tuvin, he said to him, and what else did you teach today? What else have you said recently? also in Pasuk, on a similar matter, back in Perek Zayin, this is in Kohelet, this is Kohelet Perek Zayin, Toiv acharis dova mireishisoi. That in Kohelet it says, the end of a matter is better than its beginning. Omale umaat amris be, so he says to Elisha, to Rabbi Meir, again, and how did you explain the Pasuk? What did you say? Amalei, he said to him, Yesh lecha odom shu koines choyra bina rusoi, v'hu mafsid. You have a person that goes into business when he's young and he loses all his money. V'hu v'zdiknusoi, he goes into business again in his old age, v'hu mishtakir bo, and he makes a lot of money. So you can have it so that the maturity of old age is very valuable. So tov achris dovo mireshisoi, very often you find people doing better in their old age than in their youth. Another pshat he gives, Yesh lecha odom sheyoseh ma'asim roim b'nei rusoi, v'ziknusoi yoseh ma'asim tovim. Sometimes there are people who do bad deeds in their youth, but in their old age they do well. Another pshat, Yesh lecha odom sheyoseh lomed Torah b'nei rusoi, m'shakeach. There are people who learn Torah when they're young, and they forget their Torah. V'ziknusoi v'chezer oleam. When they're old, they learn again, it comes back again. All those are examples of tov acharis dovo mireishisoi. How something can be better at the end than it was at the beginning. And all this must have hurt Elisha bin Abuya very much, because he is worse at the end than he used to be at the beginning. So it's direct musar on him. Amar Leh, so he says, Akiva Rabcho Likachoma. That's not how Rabbi Akiva learned the Pasuk. Your Rabbi Akiva didn't learn the Pasuk like that. Ela Toiv Acharis Dova. And he gives a wonderful pshat of Rabbi Akiva. And on Thursday night, I quoted this in passing, in the name of Rebellia, but it's a pshat of Rabbi Akiva, it's in Chazal, it's in the Medrash. Toiv achris dova kshu toiv mireishisa. A matter is good at its end, provided it starts off good. If the seed that was planted was healthy, then the ultimate tree will be good and will be healthy, but it must be good to start with. That's how Rabbi Akiva learned it. So what does Elisha ben Abuya find comforting about this? Why does he bring this in? What's so special here for him? So he goes on and he says, V'chi hava maisa. And so in fact was the case. Abuya ovi hayo migdoi le'ador. And Elisha ben Abuya starts telling Rabbi Meir the maisa. Abuya, my father, was one of the great people of his generation. Uchashabo lemuloni, and when it came to my bris, koro lechol gedele Yerushalayim. He called all the gedolim of Yerushalayim. V'koro leRabbi Eliezer uleRabbi Yeshua imohim. And he called Rabbi Eliezer and Rabbi Yeshua with them. Uchashachlu v'shosu shorin. And when they ate and they drank, Elun, they sang, Elun amdi mizmorin, some were saying at the bris, the suda afterwards, some were singing zmiris, Elun amrin alphabetrin, and others were saying, making up rhymes, with alphabetical rhymes. Omer Rabbi Eliezer le Rabbi Yeshua, said Rabbi Eliezer to Rabbi Yeshua, Elun askin bedidhun, they're busy doing their thing. One's telling, making rhymes, and one's singing zmiris. V'anan les anan iskin b'didon, and we're not busy in our area. They're busy. We're going to do our thing. Hischilu b'Torah. They started learning and talking Torah together. Uminat Torah l'Nevi'im, and they branched out from discussing Torah. They moved into the Nevi'im, into the prophets. Uminat Nevi'im l'Ksuvim, bo yu'advorim smeichim k'nisinosol misinai, and there was as much joy in their discussion, Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, as there was when the Torah was given at Sinai. And a spiritual form of fire came and swept around their heads. There was such joy, such simcha, and such kedusha, that fire, much like the fire that came down on Mount Sinai, actually enveloped their heads. Omar said, my father, Avuya, Hoyel v'chein hu godol koicho shel Torah. If the power of Torah is so enormous, this son, if he survives, I dedicate for Torah. such power, then my son should be dedicated for Torah. Says Elisha ben Abuya, V'al-yedei shelo hoiso kavonos machshavto l'shem shomayim, and since my father's intention in dedicating me to Torah was not l'shem shomayim, lo niskaimo bi Torosi. That's why my Torah didn't last, and that's why I landed up going off the tracks. That's what he says. And Rav Simcha Zissel asks on this medrash, it's very worrying. If the principle of Toiv Achris Dovo Mireishiso, if the principle goes so far that a thing is only good if it's good to start with, and how good does it have to be that a man like Avuyo, who dedicates his son's life to Torah because he appreciates the greatness, the power of Torah, that's not good enough? That intention at the origin of Elisha ben Abuya's career, that intention which is was not considered the Shem Shemayim, was sufficient to be the cause of Elisha ben Abuya going off the tracks? Ask something to this, what chance has anybody else got? Is that kavona more the Shem Shemayim than most people's other kavonas, or less the Shem Shemayim than most people's other kavonas? A person learns Torah because he enjoys it, a person learns Torah because he wants the knowledge, a person learns Torah because he wants the kavod. All sorts of reasons people learn Torah. And this little psul, he was one of the gedolei ador, says Elisha about his father. And he sees Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer, and we can imagine how great he was if Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer were present at the bris. And he sees Rabbi Yeshua and Rabbi Eliezer talking in Torah, and he sees this fire around their heads, and he says, goodness, if this is Torah, I want my son to be dedicated to Torah. That's not L'Shem Shemayim enough, and that flaws the entire career of Elisha ben Abuya. Ask Rav Simcha Zissel, so what chance do we have? In how many of us can we claim to have more L'Shem Shemayim than Abuya had for his son? You don't find such a thing. That's why I said it's a stunning midrash, the extent to which there has to be purity of motivation at the beginning. If a thing is constructed on ill motivation, then it has little chance of success. And that's what Eiv says, Miyitein tohir mitomei lo yechod. How can you produce tahara from tumo? How can you produce purity from impurity? We see so clearly even in the case of Elisha ben Abuya that because of a minute flaw in the intention of the father, a speck of tumo, Elisha ben Abuya goes off the tracks later on in his career. You cannot produce tahara from tumma. If it's there, it remains there all the time. And therefore, Eiv uses that as a defense for his own actions. He says to the Ribbono Shel Olam, if I've done wrong, if I've been incorrect in my behavior and my conduct, it's because who I am after all. Where do I come from? Who do I come from? I'm born from nothing, I'm going to nothing. And he virtually bases himself on the Mishnah in the beginning of the third parak of Pirkei Avos, Akavya ben Mahalalum, Omer, Istakel b'shloish advorim, ve'enato balidei Avero. Look at three things and you won't come to Avero. What are the three? Me'ayin ba'ata, where you came from, l'anato hilich, where you going to, v'lifnei mi'ato osid litzen din b'cheshven, and before whom are you accountable? And he says, me'ayin ba'ata, where do you come from? You come from a minute quantity of protein, of DNA. That's what you are. If you look at all the scientific books and all the psychology books and all the psychiatry books, more than the psychology books, a human being is nothing but. Always find somewhere scattered through the text, man is nothing but. It says that's what Rakavya ben Mahalal says. You must remember that man is nothing but a speck of DNA. That's all he is. So what do you expect of him? Expect him to become great. And what is the ultimate, this DNA as it develops in this miraculous way, in this freakish way, and develops into a human being? Fine, lovely, so you start getting hopeful and thinking something's going to come of him. What happens eventually? Rot and decay, and that's the end of it. So it comes from nowhere and it's going to nowhere. Says Eiv, Miyitein tohu mitone, how can you expect greatness to be produced from a speck of DNA when that speck of DNA is tome in itself? Shichva zero, it's tomei in itself. The reproductive cells themselves are tomeim. They're impure. and they cause tumor. Do you want to tell me that the human being created from those cells can be tohirim, can be so pure? You can't blame us, we're inadequate, because that's the way you made us. That's the way you defend yourself. But the Chazal didn't learn the Pasuk that way. The Chazal learned the Pasuk, the way the Emes is in fact. And Chazal say, Mi yite in tohu mitome lo yechod, kegoin avro miterach. Give you an example of a tohu mitome. Who was Avram's ancestry? Where did Avram come from? From Taro, from great purity? And from Terach, idol worshippers. And look what a man like Terach could produce, an Avram Avinu. There you see, Miyita and Toyu Mitome, you see a case of Taro, purity being produced out of impurity. Chizkiyahu Miochos, the great King Chizkiyahu, a tzaddik. Who was his father? Ochos, a Rosho. Look at how Tumo can produce Taro. Look at how impurity can produce the greatest of purity. Mordechai Mishimi. Mordechai, who was his ancestor? Shimi ben Gero. A Rosho. Who does he produce? Mordechai. Tumor producing Taharu. Yisrael miyumos ha'ilom. Jews being produced from non-Jews. Can happen. Tumor produces Taharu. Umi Yosochein, Umi Tzivochein, Umi Gozochein. Who decreed thus? Who created such a situation where Tumor can produce Taharu? Loy echod, loy yuchidu shalolam, surely that is Hashem. So the Medrash learns the Pasuk, mi yite in toru mitome, who can produce purity from impurity? Loy echod, is it not only the Ribbono shel Olam who can do such a thing? Toman Tanidon, there we learnt, kol ho'iskin beforo mitchilo ve'adsoif, metamin begodim, all those who deal with the poro, the Pora Aduma, from the beginning until the end, they become Tome. Behi Gufo Metaheris Tome. And the Pora Aduma itself has the power to purify the impure. The red heifer, that's what we use it for. We use it to purify people who become impure. But those who come into contact, those who actually do the process, become impure. So what is it? Is impurity producing purity, or is it producing impurity? What is the source? What is the causality? And that's what flawed the mind of Shlomo HaMelech. But we see that dichotomy already in the two ways of learning this pasuk in Iyuv. Is Iyuv making a statement? Is he giving an answer? Or is he asking a question? Is he stating that it is impossible to produce purity from impurity? Or is he questioning and saying, is it not only the Ribbono shel Olam who can produce purity from impurity? Is he acknowledging the possibility of purity being produced from impurity? Or is he denying the possibility of purity being produced from impurity? That depends on how you learn it. Rashi and the Mephoshim learn that he's denying it. The Medrash learns that he's acknowledging it. Which is true? What is correct? The Akedah asks, in Maimer 64, Shishim V'arbo, on that very piece of Pirkei Avos, the first question he asks you from Eve, how can Akavio ben Mahalil tell us to look at three things? What are the three things? The one is where you come from. The second is where you're going to. Where do you come from? From a little speck of DNA. Where are you going to? To decay and to rot and to worms. Nothing. Ask the Akedo, number one, that's not our system of Musa. Our system of Musa is to appreciate the greatness of the human being. And then you can elevate yourself. If you think of yourself as nothing but, the way the secular world sees the human being, nothing but a freak of nature, survival of the fittest, evolution, all sorts of things. If you see the human being as nothing but, then what can you expect of the human being? Nothing but. That reduces the level of expectation. If you want to expect great things from a human being, you've got to appreciate his greatness, his eternity, his spirituality, not the fact that he comes from nothing and is going to nothing. What does Akavya bin Mahal mean with this suggestion? Number two, if he's given us the suggestion of this Nehemiah to Osid Lita in Din Becheshwan, he's told us, be aware of to whom you're accountable, that one day you'll come before the Ribbono Shel Olam and you will have to explain to him and live through every thought, every word, every deed of your entire life. And you'll have to analyze it with the Ribbono Shel Olam. If you're aware of that, do you need anything more? Is there anything more than that that should be required in order to appreciate the severity of life, the importance of life, the accuracy of life? What else would one need apart from that? Why give the other two altogether? And thirdly, he proves from Eiv himself, and he says that Eiv uses this very argument. What does Eiv say? The reason I have sinned, Ribbono Shel Olam, is because I'm nothing but a speck of DNA and I'm going to nothing but decay and worms. That's Eiv's whole argument in chapter 14. So you see that Eiv takes the advice of Akavya ben Mahalal, takes two out of his three Musar images, and uses that to justify bad behavior. So why does Akavya ben Mahalal include them in a way to motivate us towards greater heights? Let him just say it. That's the Akedah's kasha on the Prekeobis. Answers the Akedah. These three pieces of advice of Akavya ben Mahalal must not be seen separately. Akavya ben Mahalal is not saying there are three ways in which one can motivate oneself to better behavior. One way is to think about where you come from. It's one. A second way is to think about where you're going to. And the third way is to think about who you're accountable to. That's not what Akavya ben Mahalal means, says the Akedah, because that would be destructive, that wouldn't be constructive. What Akavya ben Mahalal means is you need all three together to understand the principle. What is the principle? You need to realize that as far as your body is concerned, as far as the physical part of our lives is concerned, where does it come from? It's nothing but a drop of DNA. That's what it is. See it in perspective. And what is it going to become? You think it starts off as a drop of DNA, but one day it becomes great, it grows, it develops. Just follow it through to its ultimate conclusion. Here it becomes great, and then finally it declines and becomes old and dies and decays and rots, and that's the end of it. So it has no past and it has no future. You need that perception, says the Akedah, in order to understand and fully appreciate the third. Then you can understand Lifnei Oso Osid Litein Din Becheshwin. Before whom are you going to have to be accountable? Why? Because it is impossible for us to appreciate the reality of the confrontation between ourselves and the Ribbono Shel Olam, so long as we see ourselves as physical beings. We cannot picture a physical being such as ourselves standing before the Ribbono Shel Olam. We cannot picture a life after death. We cannot picture an Olam HaEmes. It's not possible to picture a world which functions only on Emes when we see ourselves in our physical clothing, when we see ourselves in our material forms. As long as we see ourselves in our material forms, it is impossible to fully appreciate Lifnei Mi Oso Osid Litein Din Becheshwan. Therefore, says Akavya ben Mahalalel, the only way you can understand the true greatness of man is to understand the nothingness of man's physical being. Then you can begin to understand his true greatness. Because if you think of yourself in the first person, and when you think of yourself in the first person, you think of the image you see in the mirror in the morning, then there's a limit to the greatness you can attribute to the human being. If you think of man, capital M, and you think of him in his physical form, and now you think to yourself, well, how great is this man? So you can think greatness. How great? He can be as great as Mars Puerta. It's great. He can be greater. He can be as great as one of the other Puertas. It's also great. One can be even greater than that. One can be as great as a de Klerk. That's still greater. One can go greater than that too. One can be as great as Shakespeare. One can be as great as Mozart. One can be as great as Einstein, but it's all limited. How much higher than that can you go? a little bit more greater. It's all relative greatness. But in terms of objective greatness, when you say good, so take your biggest man. Who's your biggest man? Who's your real hero? Shakespeare, Mozart, Einstein, whoever you want. Now put him next to the Ribbono Shel'Olam, Kibyochel. Is there anything to talk about? Nothing to talk about. He's nothing, he's a gornit. So however great we're going to picture man, as long as we see him in his physical form, there is enormous limitation to how great we can picture him. And however great we picture him, when we put that picture of him next to objective greatness, next to true greatness, next to the Ribbono Shel'Olam, that man fizzles into nothingness. Irrelevant. Says the Akedah, the only time that you can really appreciate the greatness of man is when you shatter the image of his physical form. And you allow yourself to see him only in his spiritual form. You see the neshama there. Now you can see greatness. Now you can realize you're dealing with something eternal. Now you can realize you're dealing with something that does match up to the Ribbono Shel'Olam because it's a part of the Ribbono Shel'Olam. Now you realize that you're dealing with something which has a place in an Olam HaEmes. Now you realize that you're dealing with something that is going to have to give Din B'cheshbin Lifnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's going to have to sit down at the table with the Ribbono Shel'Olam and go through every step of its life. Now you see the neshama, you see the limitlessness of human greatness. But you cannot see that human greatness for as long as you see attached to it the limitations of the human physical form. And therefore the first thing you've got to do, says Akavya bin Ma'ala, not for Musa, but just to get your perspective right, the first thing you've got to do is to realize, where do you come from? Where does your body come from? It's protein, that's all it is. Bit of DNA. And you think it can be developed into all sorts of Olympic proportions? Go further. The people who are winning the gold medals at the Olympics now, project them 40 years' time, 50 years' time, 60 years' time. How much further? What happens to them eventually? All this wonderful development of the human body? Nothing happens. Eventually it rots and decays. It's nothing. So let's get the perspective right, that the body is simply a temporary shell which eventually rots and decays. But inside that, there is a neshama. And when you realize that the body is nothing, then one is able to appreciate the enormity of the neshama. Lifnei mi oso din lisen, lifnei mi oso ato osi liten din v'cheshbin, lifnei melech malchei amroimim hakodesh baruch. We're going to have to give account to the King of Kings, the Ribbono Shel'Olam. That's how the Akedo explains that Mishnah. No, so how does Eev use it? Why does Eev miss the point? Eev uses the fact that he comes from a meaningless drop of DNA and is going to land up 6 feet under. Eev uses that as a reason to justify his bad behavior. Why is that? So I explained this morning that Eev denies, Chazal tell us, and we see it several times in the Sefer, including in this Perek, Eev denies Tchias HaMesik. Eev denies the revival of the dead. See, that he can't picture, he can't relate to the revival of the dead. But it doesn't say in Chazal that Eev denies Olam Habo, that Eev denies the world to come, that Eev denies the existence of the soul. That it doesn't say. On the contrary, we proved earlier, and I gave him a Tashabah Shirat on it as well, at the end of chapter 10, that Eev believes in Olam Haba. If he believes in Olam Haba, he denies Tchias HaMesim. Where is he going wrong? It means he does believe in the soul, he does believe in the spirit. And we're told at the beginning of the Sefer there was a Tzaddik. So he must have believed in the soul. How can one be a Tzaddik if one doesn't believe in the soul? So he believes in the soul. If he believes in the soul, why does he misunderstand the whole Mishnah of Akavya bin Ma'ala? And I gave the example of going into an antique shop and seeing on the shelf there a most beautifully painted old ostrich egg, which they're selling for 500 rand. And you're looking at the ostrich egg and admiring it, and by mistake the ostrich egg falls out of your hand, falls onto the hard floor, and it cracks. And the owner of the antique shop bursts into tears. And he's crying and he's heartbroken. And you say, no, okay, I'll pay you the 500 rand, I'm sorry. It's not that, it's just irreplaceable, it's unique. And he's sobbing his heart out at the loss of this precious ostrich egg. And you say, but I don't understand something. It so happens that a week ago I was in Otsu, you tell him, and I visited an ostrich farm, and we were watching ostrich eggs there too. Same kind of ostrich egg, same size. They weren't painted on the outside, I'll grant that. They weren't painted on the outside. And we watched, there were some ostrich eggs in an incubator, and they started to crack, and the owner of the ostrich farm jumped with joy. I don't understand. What are you supposed to do when an ostrich egg cracks? Yeah, a week ago I was with a farmer, and he was jumping with joy when the eggs cracked. Now I cracked the egg, I thought you might also jump with joy, but you didn't. You're crying and sobbing. What's the difference? What is the correct response when you see an ostrich egg break? What's the answer? Depends what's inside. If there's a little ostrich trying to get out, then when the egg cracks, you rejoice. But if there's nothing inside, then when the egg cracks, you cry. Sometimes you go into a hospital, never to visit, walk in the corridors of the hospital, and you see a man sobbing, crying. You say, what's the matter? And he says, my wife's in the ward and she's in such pain, I can't even be in it. Such pain, she's suffering. You go in and you speak to the doctor, she's in pain. Okay. You go a little bit further down the corridors, you come to the maternity ward, and there's a man, and he puts his arms around you, he says, you can wish me mazel tov, my wife's busy having a baby, and you hear crying and shouting coming from inside. You say, but why are you so happy? She's suffering so much. Yeah, but good. She's having a baby. So what are you supposed to do when your wife's in pain? Are you supposed to rejoice and say you can wish me mazel tov? Or are you supposed to cry? It depends what's inside. If the pain is releasing a baby, then one rejoices. The pain is irrelevant. The important thing is the baby. Even the mother eventually gets over the pain and forgets about it. But if there's nothing coming out, if it's just pain and nothing is going to be produced, and it's a cause for concern, for worry, and for upset. Even if it's not serious, just the pain is something which causes one to cry. And it doesn't help having the baby somewhere else. For example, if the mother is suffering pain in the nursing home, you can't say to the husband, well, why are you crying? You've got a baby at home. What's the one got to do with the other? He's happy about the baby at home, but his wife's suffering pain. The only time that the pain is bearable is when the pain itself is producing the baby, then there's cause for rejoicing. When the cracking of the ostrich egg is in order to let the ostrich out, then there's a reason for rejoicing. But when there's nothing inside, it doesn't help that you've got 100 ostriches as well. The egg is broken. And so when things get cracked and broken, it depends how we view them as to whether we're going to rejoice or we're going to cry. This yesod was understood with all the depth and drama that it entailed by none other than Einstein, when he realized that in every atom of matter there is potentially the most enormous quantity of energy, but you've got to shatter that atom first. And when the atom has been shattered, that energy can come out. There has to be a shattering process first in order to release the energy. And that's what the Akedo says in his understanding of the Mishnah of Akavya ben Mahalalel. You can only release the spiritual energy of Nifnei Mi'at Ha'osid Lisa and Din V'cheshbon if you crack that physical image of that big ego of who I am, of my physical appearance. When that's brought down to its nothing, when you've shattered that image, then you can release spiritual energy of Mi'at Ha'osid Lisa and Din V'cheshbon. Then you can see yourself as part of Olam Ha'emes. Then you can see yourself as part of a communication with the Ribbono Shel Olam, of a dialogue with the Ribbono Shel Olam, of being judged by the Ribbono Shel Olam. Once all that has been removed, but that physical image first must be shattered. And that's what Akavya bin Mahalal says in his instruction of think where you're coming from and think where you're going on. That's as far as the body is concerned. But as far as the neshama is concerned, once you've wrecked your body in concept, once you've wrecked that physical ego, now you've got to think of your neshama, now you've got to think of your soul in terms of lifnei mi'at ha'osid lifnei din v'cheshbon. And then one has the musar all well in hand. And so it is in all areas that the physical things need to be broken open to release the potential energy that lies inside them. And that's the uniqueness of a Torah approach. We don't see the physical world as separate. That was the mistake Eve was making. Eve says, there's a neshama, I believe in the neshama. The neshama is hovering around somewhere. And it's eternal, fine, no problem. But it has nothing to do with my body. And therefore all the pain and suffering that my body is enduring has no bearing on my neshama. Because I don't believe in Tchiyas HaMeisim. What does Tchiyas HaMeisim mean? That my neshama can reconstitute my body. Eve had never heard of Einstein's theory, that's all. He didn't know that it's transferable, the body is the soul has the body, and they can, the soul can later on regenerate another body. That he wasn't prepared to accept, that they're intricately bound, the body and the soul, that much. As other religions until today believe. The physical world is one area, and the spiritual world is another area, and they hardly come into contact with one another. That's not Yiddishkeit, that's not Torah. We believe that the physical world is an outer shell that contains buried deep within it the most enormous spiritual power, and that spiritual power cannot be released until the outer shell is cracked open. When the material, when matter is split and is cracked open, then there's the release of all that nuclear energy, of all that spiritual energy. And so, in the simple translation, the way the Mefarshim learn it, when Eve says, Miyite in Torah mitome le'echod, Eve says, it is not possible to produce purity from impurity. That cannot be. But, where the way Chazal learn it, the Ribbono Shel Olam, through the Ribbono Shel Olam's methods, it is possible to crack impurity, to destroy that shell of impurity, and from that to release the forces of Tahara. We see that in the continuation, in fact, of the Medrash that we started with. Because later on, the Medrash tells us, La'achar yomim cholo Elisha ben Avuyo. After a period of time, Elisha ben Avuyo took ill. Osun ve'omrin le'Rabbi Meir, Elisha rabcho chile. And they came and told Rabbi Meir, Elisha your Rebbe is ill. Ozal le'gabe. So Rabbi Meir went to visit Elisha ben Abuyo, his Rebbe. Amalei, and he said to Elisha, Chazor b'cho. Perhaps you'll do tshuva. Now Elisha had already told him earlier on in the posuk, in the Medrash, that he feels he can't do tshuva, because one day on Yom Kippur, which fell on a Shabbos, he was riding his horse past the shul. And he heard a voice coming out, Shuvu, saying, Shuvu vonim shuvuvim. Return unto me, you misbehaved children. Shuvu elai or shuvu aleichem. Posuk from Yirmiyo. He heard it coming out from the shul. Return unto me and I will return to you. Chutz me Elisha ben Avuyo. And he heard the posuk go on and say, with the exception of Elisha ben Avuyo, because Elisha knew my greatness and he rebelled against me. So Elisha can't do tshuva. So Elisha's already taken the view that he can't do tshuva, and on his deathbed Rabbi Meir appeals for him to do tshuva. Amalei, he says to Rabbi Meir, Va'ad kedoin mekablin? Would they take me back at this point? Have I not gone too far? Amalei, says Rabbi Meir to Elisha ben Abuya, Alik siv toshev enosh ad dako? That a man can return right from the depths of depression, ad digduku shel nefesh, until from the most lowest levels of the soul, it's possible to do tshuva. Ba'oisosho bocho Elisha ben Avuyo. At that statement, Elisha ben Avuyo sobbed for mes and he died. Ba'hoyo Rabbi Meir someach, and Rabbi Meir had joy. Va'omer, and he said, Doimer, it appears to me that my Rebbe died doing tshuva. That cry was already tshuva, says Rabbi Meir. What do we see here? That although Elisha ben Abuyo had adopted the view throughout his life of Toiv Acharis Dova Mireishisa, that a thing is good at the end only if it was good to start with, and he attributed his deviation from the line of Torah to the questionable motivations of his father at his bris, and he'd heard it said on Yom Kippur that everybody can do tshuva chutz min Elisha ben Abuyo, so he believed he was beyond repair. So it was his belief, like Eev says, miyitin tore mitome, there was a speck of tumor at my origin, and I can never overcome that. On his deathbed, he has yisurin, his suffering. What does that mean, his suffering? The outer shell is being cracked. The outer shell is being hammered. That ego, the image of himself, is being lowered. Bilam says the Medrash, that is the role of the Jewish people. Not just to survive. The role of the Jewish people is to fight, to struggle, and to destroy falsehood. That's what we're here for. We're not here to flow with the stream. We're not here to do what everybody else is doing, to accept the norms and the value systems that everybody else accepts. We're here to shatter that and to destroy that, and to establish MS in the world. To establish truth and to establish harmony and to establish Torah in the world. That's what we have to do. And the same applies as we get closer and closer to home. That's what the Jew has to do in the Gabi with respect to the rest of the world. And the religious Jew has to do with respect to the secular world. And each individual Jew has to do with respect to the larger community. To battle norms and values which are accepted if they're incorrect. To battle them if they're sheker. To battle them if they're false. And to introduce and to fight and to struggle for emes. Not to take the viewpoint, I don't want to get involved. Machlikis, you know, the sholim, a person has to stay out of things. That's not what it's all about. You stay out of things when the machlikis does not involve emes and sheker. But when the machlikis involves emes and sheker, you roll up your sleeves and you get into it. That's what we're meant to do. Only that way can tumor produce tahara. If one shatters the tumor, if one destroys the tumor, then in fact it can produce purity, and purity can be developed from it. And that's the Lefum Tzairo Igra. We discussed 2 weeks ago and again last week, what is this Lefum Tzairo Igra? What's the greatest example of Lefum Tzairo Igra? Not doing wrong. Doing good, is that's one part. And if it's hard to do the good, there's more tzairo. But the greatest area of Lefum Tzairo Igra is controlling oneself. Is holding back from doing the things one wants to do. That hurts. But what is it that's hurting? It's the controlling of the Yetzer Hara. It's the fighting of Sheker. It's the fighting of Ra. The battle against evil, which has to take place not only in the world stage, not only in the dramatics of a Mordechai versus Haman, of a Yisroel versus Amalek. That's not the only area that one has to battle. One has to battle within oneself all the time. Struggle and battle for the destruction of evil, for the destruction of that which is negative, for the destruction of that which is dishonest, of that which is sheker. Only then, if there is that tsar, the tsar of battling with the yetzer, then what happens? Then there's igra. Why is there igra? Because the mitzvah is better. And here we have the big difference between the gardener and ourselves. When the gardener has a headache, there's no connection between his headache and the work he's doing in the garden, except it makes it harder, that's all. But it doesn't make the gardening better. Either of it. If anything, it makes the gardening worse. If a man is working at his job and he's got sores, he's got children who are ill, that doesn't make him do the job better. That makes him do the job worse. So of course there's no lefum tzairo igro in the physical world. We're not going to pay people more because they've got sores. That's not our problem. And if two people come for a job, and one person says he's ready to roll up his sleeves and to get busy and he wants the job, and another person says he also wants the job very badly, that you must understand he's got big sores. There's some days he might not turn up to work, and when he does turn up to work, he mustn't worry if he's not very productive because he's got big sores. Who are we going to give the job to? Out of sympathy, are we going to say, oh, Lefum Tzairo Igra, I've been looking for a person with sores. That's what I've been looking for. Says the Bidrochov, the Ribbono Shalom, repays us in accordance with our Torah. So I also want to pay a person who's got a lot of Torah. It doesn't matter what you do. We don't operate that way. Because there's no connection between the Torah. Or rather, the connection is inverse. The more the Tzar, the worse the productivity. That's when it's a shell with nothing inside. But when there's a baby inside trying to come out, then the more the Tzar, the greater the productivity, until that egg starts splitting. Until that egg starts breaking, the chicken can't get out. Until the mother starts having labor pains, the baby can't get out. Lefum tsar o'igra doesn't just mean that God rewards the punishment. Lefum tsar o'igra means that where there is tsar, where there is pain, where there is a shattering of the ego, there's better mitzvah, there's better avodas Hashem, there's better limud ha-Torah. Limud ha-Torah, avodas Hashem, doesn't take place out of revocha, doesn't take place out of comfort and luxury. That's not where it's better. That's where it's challenging, that's where it's much harder to be able to learn when one's comfortable, to be able to govern when one's comfortable. And the din is, for Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, a shliach tzibur should be somebody who's married, preferably with children already. Why? Different when you've got to be mispalil and you're on your own. You can survive with very little. If you're just recently married, you can still survive with very little. On the contrary, the chances are the husband works, the wife works at the one time that the family will experience affluence. Both are working and there are no children, there are no expenses. So in a sense, there's affluence. It's a nes min ha-shamayim, but it doesn't work that way. It's a nes min ha-shamayim that as people get on, they usually do better. It shouldn't be that way at all. The one time that a family has to really make it financially is when husband and wife are working and there are no children. And usually there's not even a bond on the house yet. They don't have a house yet. So what do? They're paying a bit of rent. They're living in a one-room department. Two sources of income, no expenses. They should be on top of the world. The Rebbe Yisrael makes sure that as we grow and our needs grow, he provides for us. It's a wonder. It's against nature, but so he does. But a person who's recently married and doesn't have much expense and much worry, or a person who's not married at all, is not suitable to be a Shliach Tzibur or a Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, because he doesn't know what it is to face the fears of the future. He doesn't have that tzar, the tzar gidubonim, the concern, the worry. Where am I going to provide for them from? It's all very well, we're just making it now, but the children are growing up, there's education, there are all sorts of expenses that there are going to be, there's health of the family that we need, I need to be healthy, my wife needs to be healthy, we want our children to be healthy. It's a different kind of davening when there's the tzar, when there's the pain of real life. Different kind of davening altogether. That's why perhaps it's very difficult to teach true Torah to university students. They're living in a protected environment without any tzar. What's their against the tzar? They're going to pass an exam at the end of the year. That's the extent of their tzar. And they think that's tzar. They think that's the real thing. It's very difficult when a person doesn't even know what the tzar of day-to-day life is to be talking reality to. It doesn't exist. With yeshiva students, that's not the case. The yeshiva student has the tzar of Yerushalayim, you remember we discussed 2 weeks ago. He has the tzar. Is he living up to it? Is he serving the Ribbono Shel Olam properly? Is he controlling his mind correctly? Is he learning to his maximum ability? It's not a question of exams there. There he's busy with real life. But in the unreal academic environment, people aren't busy with real life. They're not experiencing real life. They don't have that kind of tzar. And therefore it's a different kind of existence. Where this tzar? We daven before we eat, shachris before breakfast, mincha before lunch, maariv before supper. Much better than davening afterwards. Daven on an empty stomach. Davening is better, always better. That's how it is. I gave the example in the ladies' shiur today, and there were a few knowing nods of the husbands who packed their suitcases up with tzforim on their way to vacation at the end of the year. A pleasure. 3 weeks with nothing to do. All this year I've had to battle, and how much time have I had? Oh, an hour here, half an hour there. It's been so difficult, but in front of me there are 3 weeks with nothing to do. So good, we're going to take the children on outings, it's fine, in the morning. Come back for a rest in the afternoon, fine, but there's a late afternoon, there's an evening, there's a night, nothing to do. And the sforim go into the suitcase. And one comes back from the holiday always a little disappointed. This sefer wasn't opened, and this sefer wasn't open, and this sefer wasn't open, and this sefer I looked at once, and this sefer I looked at twice, and you feel a little guilty. But it's just the facts of life. You learn more under pressure. Don't think that when you're on holiday you're going to do better. When you're on holiday you're going to do worse. Your body will do better, but not your neshama. The neshama does best when it's under pressure. That's why you get people to say that you're not learning well. Why are you not learning? Just too much pressure. Doesn't work, too much pressure, therefore I'm not learning well. If you're not learning well when you're under a lot of pressure, what do you expect to learn well when the pressure's off? Is that what you expect? Never! That won't take place. The only time you've got a chance of a good Avodat Hashem is when there's pressure. Then you know what it is to work at your maximum potential. Then you know what it is to utilize every minute. Then you know what it is to value time. The moment that pressure is removed and there's no pressure anymore and time is endless, what do you expect? That then you're going to utilize time properly. Then you sit back. That's the time one doesn't function. That's the time one doesn't progress. When it comes to Torah and Avodas Hashem, the more tzar, the greater the Torah. The more tzar, the greater the Avodah. The more tzar, the greater the mitzvahs. Nobody wants time. We discussed that last 2 weeks ago. It's the Petterburger said, we're not permitted to go looking for pain and suffering. Nobody wants that. Excepting the areas of Yerushalayim. One can bring about that sense of tension through greater awareness of Yerushalayim. But apart from that, and although nobody wants it, there is no question that when one visits people who are never terribly ill, there is a sensitivity, there is a perception, there's a sense of values, which is different to the healthy person. You go to a sports club and you watch people playing squash, you watch people playing tennis, you think these people should be on the top of the world, fit, healthy, they should be praising the Ribbono Shel Olam for their good health. You look outside in the car park of the sports club and you see the Porsches and the Mercedes-Benzes and the Rolls Royces and you think, my goodness, this must be Gan Eden here. Let's go and see these people. They're healthy, they're able to play sport. They're wealthy, they've got money. They've got whatever they want. Let's go and see them. Walk inside, you watch them playing, they look the picture of good health, and you think, my goodness, when they come off that tennis court, what are they going to do? You imagine they're going to sit down and they're going to chazer their gemara and talk over their latest shiur with one another, check what chesed the one can do with the others, anybody that needs anything, what chesed, who's ill, what... Must be that they want to repay the Ribbono Shel Olam somewhere. So you wait, they come in for a drink, no brocha, nivul peh, dirty jokes, the bottom of the barrel. You go into the hospital to visit, and you think, oh, what am I going to hear people here? People are going to be angry at the Ribbono Shel Olam, disappointed. They're going to have thrown up their Yiddishkeit. They're going to want to have nothing to do with me. I'm a frum person. They're going to throw me out of their ward. Is this what your God has done to me? And you come in there, and there's a shalom aleichem, and the sick person starts asking you how you are, and how's your family, and how are your children, and what news, and how's so-and-so, and how's so-and-so. And all of a sudden you realize this person's here thinking about others, not about himself. And you've just come from the sports club, where they were thinking about themselves, not about others. Great spirituality doesn't go hand in hand with great physical development, and with comfort, and with wealth. Doesn't. And that's why the challenge is to be great when things are going well. When things are going hard, it's not so difficult to be great. That's part of the blessing, so to say, of difficult times. But when things are going well, that's the time it's really difficult to achieve great levels. Says Reb Simcha Zissel, that cry of Elisha ben Abuya, that's all he needed for Rabbi Meir to say, Doimeh, it appears that my Rebbe has died with tshuva. That was tshuva. Says Reb Simcha Zissel, when a person learns Torah, there's no chance that he can really expect that his learning is more l'shem shemayim than Elisha ben Abuya's was in his good days, or that it's more l'shem shemayim than Elisha ben Abuya's father intended Elisha's learning to be. He's sitting down and learning. How many of us can say that we feel satisfied that our learning is more l'shem shemayim? Very difficult to say. And therefore comes the question, Toiv reishis dolo me'acharisa, Toiv achris dolo me'rishisa. So if our motivation is not pure, how can our Torah be pure? Says the Simcha Zissel, the test is Musa. If a person is learning Musa as well, but learning Musa means not just learning Musa philosophically. Learning Musa means learning to the point where tears roll down the face. Then one knows what's learning Musa. If a person sits and he learns Musa once a week, twice a week, what are his motivations? Is this in order to make him great, so that he can say a good shiur? Is this in order that he can show somebody else up? Is this in order to give him honor? No, this is obscene for this. That's a proof of the sincerity of intent. Where you see a learning program that does not include serious musa, then you know that the learning can't be toiv mirei shisoi. The motivations can't be good from their origins. There's a tumor in the origin, and mi yitein toher mitome. How can purity be born out of impurity? Unless the impurity is smashed! And what smashes that impurity? Only when one confronts oneself through the method of Musa, when one is actually able to sit and to analyze oneself, and there's a confrontation with one's motivations, then one's able to smash it. And then one is able to achieve a situation that Elisha ben Abuya achieved only at the end of his life. Bocho, he cried, and that one sob before he died was his tshuva. That was already shattering the ego, shattering that shell which would allow the spirituality to come out. That has to be there. The more we learn, the more spirituality we're developing, that's true. But it's all developing inside that shell. And the shell gets thicker and thicker to hold all that power inside it. And there's nothing that that power can do, it's dormant. Until the shell is shattered. And when we're able to shatter the shell, we can release all of that. And then we're able to say, as Chazal learned, then we can learn that is it possible for tome to be produced, for tzara, for purity to be produced from tuma, from impurity? Yes, the Ribbono Shel Olam says it is possible. Mordechai was produced from Shimi, Chizkiyahu was produced from Ochaz, Avraham was produced from Terach. It can be done, provided we set about, both within ourselves personally and in our wider activities, not to live side by side with Sheker, not to live side by side with the physical forces of life and the material forces of life, but to set about breaking them open, smashing them and smattering them, then we can be sure that the spiritual tahara, that purity which lies inside, that potential purity which lies inside, can be released, and Tomei can in fact produce, Toher can produce purity.